Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
It's from Roloff van den Broek, from his work entitled Gnosticism. He explains that the Gnostic religion is understood as a phenomenon that flourished in the great myths of the 2nd and 3rd century, which spread across the Middle East and Roman Empire, up to the Far East. Van den Broek enumerates four typical features of Gnosticism. 1. A distinction is made between the highest unknown God and the imperfect or plainly evil creator God, who is often identified with the God of the Bible. 2. This is often connected with an extensive description of the divine world, or pleroma, from which the essential core of human beings derives, and of a disastrous fall of a divine being, Sophia or wisdom, in this upper world. 3. As a result, humankind has become entrapped in the earthly condition of oblivion and death, from which it is saved by the revelation of Gnosis by one or more heavenly messengers. 4. Salvation is often actualized and celebrated in rituals that are performed within the Gnostic community. Or we can take the simple definition of Andrew Philip Smith from his book, John the Baptist and the Gnostics. It goes, "Stuff like what the ancient Gnostics used to do." I should mention that an important component of Gnosticism, and certainly Gnosis, is gratitude. And you can certainly find it aplenty in the Nag Hammadi library and Hermetic texts. In many hymns and prayers, even in the surly Asethian gospel. The truth of this universe is horror, but this also comes with awe, for there is a knowledge of higher realities, and that something can be done to rescue the light from the darkness of mere being. There's no reason one can't hold awe and horror at the same time in one's mind, and they're probably overlapping feelings when you think about it. Let us end with the prayer of thanksgiving from the Nag Hammadi library. We give thanks to you. Every soul and heart is lifted up to you. Undisturbed name, honored with the name, quote, God, and praised with the name, quote, Father. For to everyone and everything comes the fatherly kindness and affection of love, and any teaching there may be that is sweet and plain, giving us mind, speech, and knowledge. Mind, so that we may understand you. Speech, so that we may expound you. Knowledge, so that we may know you. We rejoice, having been illuminated by your knowledge. We rejoice, because you have shown us yourself. We rejoice, because while we are in the body, you have made us divine through your knowledge. Happy heresies and welcome to the desert of the real. I hope you like that little intro from my video, What is Gnosticism? A little primer for what we're going to really get our hands dirty today. And I hope it stays up. YouTube has been on this tear of removing videos because of copyright, even when I tested and they're like, oh, it's fine. Then a month later, they're like, we got to remove that section. But I hope you enjoyed it while you can. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am honored to be your Pompidus of Gnosis, awe and horror. That's certainly what we will be getting in today as we will delve into probably my favorite writer, Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian, along with Valis, Lord of the Rings, Seize the Day by Saul Bellow, and some other is one of my favorite all-time novels. And to do this, it is an honor to have Ian at the Virtual Alexandria. And your last name, Ian, is it Katanak? And I apologize if I put, got it right on the first time. Welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Shout out to everyone out there. Shout out to all the Archons, the Ops. I am finally here. I started listening to Miguel 11 years ago, everyone. I finally made it. I made it big, everybody. So let's go.
You have gained the attention of the Archons. They're going to let you have it. But no, no. Better be awake and in the battlefield. No, and Ian is the host of Right Conscious, both the YouTube channel and an excellent Substack. And he is putting out easily the best content on Cormac McCarthy, especially his esoteric and hidden side. Again, we all, the world wants to hide the mystic sides of so many people, as we've seen on AM Byte, whether it's Sylvia Plath or Elvis, or even I'm doing research on David Bowie, and biographers are doing, they are pushing David Bowie's like magical side to one. But here we show that these mystic realities were true, and they really are an essential part of all these great minds that have changed history, that have changed the collective psyche, and so forth. So it's awesome. With us too, we've got Graham. Graham Pong, how are you doing?
Doing very good. I want to hear all about Cormac McCarthy. You know, this is no country for old men like me, so let's get the show on the road.
That's cool. Awesome. As grandma, the only good thing about getting old is dying. So,
oh, I love it. No one here gets out alive, as Jim Morrison said. And the occult Jim Morrison is coming out this year. So, we're going to find a brand new dimension on Dionysus himself, the Lizard King. So, the fun never starts, and never stops once you wake up. So, well, why don't we get started for the audience? Good to see everybody in the chat. Already a good audience. Hope everybody's having a good Tuesday and had a good holiday weekend. If you celebrated, please super chat your questions for Ian or your complaints for me, and so we can separate them and get to them. And yeah, that's it. I think later this week, I think on Thursday, Mitch Horowitz is going to join us to discuss his new book, Happy Warrior. So we will get into some new thought. And he's going to discuss a little Gurdjieff and false realities as a setup for Astronosis. Hope to see you there. And Vance has returned from his sabbatical, but he's getting back into work. I think we will see him June 11th on an evening show on Sigil. So Vance is back, but Graham has been great at holding down the fort. Well, Ian, why don't we start a little with you? How did you get into your YouTube channel and all that good stuff?
I was inspired a long time ago by guys like you, just hearing. I used to work as a security guard in Las Vegas on the Strip, and I was so bad at it, Miguel. I am not a confrontational person. I don't care if you steal, you rob casino people, if you cause violence. Like, I didn't really care. So they would throw me in these back rooms at night from like midnight to like 8 a.m. where I would just guard equipment, guard the DJ stuff. And so I would just listen to podcasts the entire time, and that's where I heard about you and so many others. So I just kind of knew. I was like, damn, one day I want to do this. And eventually I started going to some conferences, and I saw the people I would meet, you know, speakers and these people who I idolized in person. I was like, wait, I could do this. Like, I remember, I won't say any names, but people I know, you know, I remember after the show, I saw them at the bar and they were just getting drunk and acting like fools and smoking cigs. And just like, I was like, damn, like, if I focus, I can do this one day. Like, so that's how I kind of got into the YouTube game. But Cormac McCarthy, in 2007, I was 14 years old. My dad took me to see No Country for Old Men. And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, holy hell, this is great. And somehow, for what some crazy reason, my school library had his entire bibliography. So I just checked it out, started reading, and I didn't necessarily understand it too deeply. I kind of liked the violence and stuff. But later on in college and stuff, I got back into him again. And then, of course, when I started my YouTube channel, I was like, okay, we got to cover a lot of Cormac.
And you have, and you've done an excellent job. Yeah, Blood Meridian, I think, is the greatest American novel. It's one of those rare books that you don't read, you experience, especially the Comanche battle is probably the most visceral scene I have ever seen. You're talking somebody who has no problem with, you know, Terrifier 2 or Martyrs or hardcore horror, you know, who watches Faces of Death, but the Comanche battle I've never like recovered from it. And the rest of the novel is just as powerful. And as I would later find out, extremely Gnostic. And so it's been quite a journey. So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Blood Meridian, or shall we share about Cormac McCarthy and what his influences were? You let us know, man.
Yeah, let's actually, I can walk us through some of this, because it's going to build as we're starting to move through Cormac McCarthy, a lot of this, because we're hopefully right now, today, on this channel, we're going to do the full breakdown of Cormac McCarthy's Gnostic connections. And it's not just Gnosticism. Today, we're going to be talking about Freemasonry, Kabbalah, Tarot, astrology, all things Cormac McCarthy was into, which all kind of connect once you start getting into the mystical side of reality. And so Cormac embeds all of those things into a lot of his works. But how did he get there? And why was it important to him? Because, like, I'm sure Miguel and I have interests that we don't talk about on YouTube or we don't write about, but how do some of these become so important that we want to, you know, discuss them? And what's interesting about McCarthy's prose is that most of the time the characters have no interiority. We never get into their feelings. Very rarely we do. And this is akin to Hemingway. And when we analyze Hemingway's literature, there's a term for it. It's called the iceberg theory. We have these characters. I should have an image for this. We have these characters and their conscious actions, but below it's this entire iceberg, which is the unconscious. And McCarthy is inviting interpretation by not giving us interiority with his characters, because then it's up to us to interpret. And this is a kind of Gnostic or a form of gnosis, because we are doing this action oriented, we're having a reciprocal relationship with literature. And this is kind of the antithetical approach to Dostoevsky or Proust, who you get into their heads, you're stuck for 800 pages in some random incel's fucking head. And you're like, God damn it. What am I doing here? What is happening? But Cormac doesn't deal with that. But this is interesting, because by making us engage with the literature, by not telling us everything, McCarthy is asking us to transform our own lives, because when he's not asking us to read passively. So that's kind of the basis of all of this. And McCarthy, at the start of Blood Meridian, evokes Jacob Bohme, who is obviously a German mystic and was kind of a progenitor of a lot of Gnosticism making its way back into thought. And he was also a German idealist. So yeah. When we start to examine all of McCarthy's works, two things we need to look out for is obviously Gnosticism and German idealism, because McCarthy loves a certain philosophical lineage that starts with Heraclitus, who, you know, Heraclitus, and it goes to Zeno, Marcus Aurelius, Spinoza, Schelling, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, then Heidegger, which is my favorite philosophical lineage. If you guys have heard of those names, like Schelling and Nietzsche, mm-hmm. Heidegger, Schopenhauer, they are super pessimistic at times, very much, you know, embody a lot of McCarthy's characters. But that's a certain lineage that ties to German idealism that he embodies and really cares about. But what's interesting about that is McCarthy is a scientific man. We know about his history with the Santa Fe Institute and a lot of these different things. So why doesn't he herald the champions of science, Descartes, Newton, Francis Bacon? We never hear him talk about that, because as Heidegger said, going back to them, Descartes and that whole crowd of goons, they said that we have authority over the world. They were, you know, a part of Christianity furthering its separation between us and nature. But Heidegger said that men need to be shepherds of beings. And we are here as caretakers of the world and all of its forms, which is kind of more of a pagan belief that kind of goes back to Spinoza and Heraclitus once again.
Right.
And so, and this kind of moves us into this idea of setting, because before we examine any of these novels, Blood Meridian, No Country for Old Men, The Road, the most striking thing of McCarthy's work is suddenly you see these three paragraph long descriptions of setting, and they're beautiful. They have all this symbolism. You're like, why the hell is he doing this? Maybe when I first saw, I was like, dude, he's just trying to show his cock, you know. He's like, damn, I'm the best. Like,
no, like, one's joking when he describes 10 pages of scenery.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not good enough to do that right now. So he's just showing everyone, like, don't fuck with me. That's what I thought for a while, you know. But
yeah, for sure.
This connects back. So the first thing McCarthy does with his settings is he tries to make it a character. And this stems to his love of Schelling and Schelling's idea of natural philosophy. And Schelling is kind of one of the more underrated, under-talked about German idealists. And McCarthy embeds symbols and codes within the setting for us to interpret it. And Schelling talked about what Schelling's main thesis and kind of Bohm's is that nature is God's unconscious and it functions as a tool for God to attain gnosis. And I don't know exactly what God they were talking about, the God above God or the demiurge or another archon. I don't know exactly, but Jacob Bohm invented this kind of stem of idealist metaphysics, and he called this coincidentally the dark fire, which we'll talk about later, which kind of connects to the road. And so when we have these codes and these meanings and these things within the setting and within the novel, what McCarthy is doing is making us engage in something called animism. And animism is a pagan belief, and it's the attribution of a soul to animals, plants, and inanimate objects, excuse me. And Gnosticism is obviously animistic because of the belief that parts of the God above God are embedded in this world. So everything in this reality is, you know, has at least a fragment of the God above God within it. And our, you know, purpose here on earth is to, you know, through gnosis, to connect to certain aspects of that. And this also connects this really fast to the idea in the epilogue of Blood Meridian, where they're striking fire into the holes. They're, you know, it's this concept of gnosis we'll kind of get into later. And McCarthy wants us to engage with literature. And this is all me telling you that this is a relationship that we've been ripped out of animism by Christianity in our society, because we don't think that our reality is reciprocal. All pagan cultures believe that you could interact on many different levels with plants, animals, all these different things. But when we became the dominators of Earth, we didn't need to have that anymore. That frame of mind didn't really work. Oh, and the real reason that we don't have that frame of mind anymore is the alphabet, because the alphabet is the greatest form of animism. When I look here at some of the notes that I'm not really looking at right now, When I read these words, images come up in my head. I start hallucinating. When we're reading, we're imagining. I'm hearing the voices. When I read Judge Holden talking, it's not in Ian Cadnack's voice. It's in Judge Holden's voice, whatever that is for me. And so it's literally animistic, because these words, I'm engaging with these words, and these words are engaging with me. And the alphabet is the greatest form of animism, and because it does this instantly. If you can read, you can experience these hallucinations. You don't need to go on a vision quest. Like, for instance, my sister is very much into spirituality, and she's going for 5 days up in New York this year, and she's going to go 5 days without any food or any water, and she's going to have someone watch over her. But that's to evoke visions. That's hard work. Like, holy shit. But yeah, I could just read and have the same effect at some level. And so it's this shortcut that eventually made us unrealize all these old teachings and ideas that help us actually gain gnosis, the real things. Because most of the time through words, you're not going to experience gnosis. In meditation, out in the world, through love, things that aren't necessarily tangible or even real are how we really connect with the God above God. And McCarthy calls upon us to, once we've got enough knowledge, and this is the whole point of my challenge, we must balance the pen and the sword, because once we have enough knowledge, we have to go out into the world and change something. There's so many nerds and virgins out there in the world right now who love read. They're smarter than me, smarter than Miguel, but they do nothing with their knowledge. They are jokes. And McCarthy calls upon them at the end of his Border trilogy. He makes a weird dedication. He finishes the series, and the next page, there's this dedication. And he writes, quote, "I will be your child to hold, and you be me when I'm old. The world grows cold. The heathens rage. The story's told. Turn the page." He's asking us to put down the books. The story's been told. Turn the page and go out into the world and create real change. And this is what McCarthy is doing and asking us to do by just not letting us inside character's head. heads. There we go. That's a quick introduction.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. Yeah. And of course, it should be mentioned before we even get into the mysticism. Before Cormac McCarthy, one of my favorite authors, still is, was Flannery O'Connor. And she, that sort of Catholic, Southern Gothic, and you see it in William Faulkner. Somebody said, this style is not, the South isn't Christ saved, it's Christ haunted, where Jesus is tormenting the society. You could see it in their literature. So, but of course, Cormac McCarthy, he's not in the South, he's in the Southwest, but he takes that sort of dark vibe, doesn't he?
Well, I know you haven't read some of his early works, but Cormac McCarthy, if we want to get into this right now, this is where I was going to segue to, talking about Flannery O'Connor. McCarthy, at 8 years old, moved from Rhode Island to the dark woods of Tennessee. He was living south of Knoxville, and his first four stories actually embody all take place in the South. And earlier, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I guess I can now. Thank you. I talked about Heidegger and Spinoza and Nietzsche and that whole lineage. But where does that lineage go? Because you're like, Cormac McCarthy after Heidegger. But actually, the postmodernists, Derrida, Foucault, all those guys are actually the next step of that lineage. But you look at McCarthy and you're like, he's not a postmodernist. He's not writing about dildos and gay people or like anything like that. You're like, wait, this isn't, something's wrong here. But he is because when we look at every single McCarthy novel, his first novel was a recollection of a memory. His second novel, Outer Dark, was a nightmare. His third novel was about a necrophiliac. His fourth novel had a bunch of mystical experiences in it. Blood Meridian is a fever dream. Every single one of his novels is very postmodernist because that's when he was raised. That's when he was coming up. And so he actually was very inspired by Flannery O'Connor because in 1962, I think, the year before he published his first novel, she died. And he grew up reading her stories. We know that he respected her highly. I saw him talk about her in the archive. So, but what do you do though? So you have Flannery O'Connor, who's an OG, right? And back in the day, you couldn't publish some bullshit on Kindle. You couldn't just write some shitty book and publish it. You had to be good. It had to get published. So he's sitting there and he's like, oh God, I have to stand upon the shoulders of Flannery O'Connor right now. This isn't easy. And so how can I do that? I can add postmodernist elements. I can do these framings, these recollections of a memory, a nightmare, a fever dream. These are things that O'Connor didn't do because she was from the modernist era that didn't really explore that. And so he, stood upon her shoulders and became kind of the postmodernist Southern Gothic king for a while. But what's interesting about McCarthy, you guys, and we're kind of, and this is going to help us understand how he got into Gnosticism. Our conception of McCarthy is WWE marketing. When I think of McCarthy, like pro wrestling, he is not who you think he is. And this is what I talk about on my channel all the time because he was built by marketing. In 1991, everyone, McCarthy was a poor writer. All of his books before that had sold less than 2,000 copies. Blood Meridian sold 1,700 copies. And let me put that in today's terms. Imagine writing Blood Meridian. I wish I could hold it up. And you get less than $5,000 for it. Could you imagine how bad that must feel? You write the greatest novel of all time. Yeah, here's $5,000. No one cares. There's no reviews. It fucking sucks, right? Yeah. Like nobody wants. And so he was living this harsh life where no one cared about his stuff. And so I think he eventually got fed up. And so his editor retired. He's like, okay, I'm going to try someone new. And they built him up. They put him in magazines. They put him in Esquire. They put him in female magazines. They said, there's this reclusive writer who's a cowboy. He doesn't talk to anyone. He doesn't talk about his writing. They did all these profiles and all this stuff. They built him up. And within 6 months, all the Pretty Horses sold 200,000 copies. All his previous novels combined sold less than 20,000 copies total. Total blow up in 6 months. And so after that, though, he rode that wave. He rode that wave of marketing because he didn't care. He didn't want to talk to anyone anyway. She's like, I'm just going to let them market me. So a lot of our conceptions of Cormac McCarthy are actually not real. So as I just mentioned, Cormac McCarthy was born in Tennessee. But when you think, cowboy, he must have had this hard upbringing. No, his dad was a rich lawyer. His dad worked for the terrible. His dad worked for the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was a government institution that ripped people off of their land, basically. At that time, they were trying to make dams and create the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee. But all throughout that area, there were people living on that land, some with house titles and some without. So his dad was the head attorney, the head guy who did eminent domain on all these people. His dad threw thousands of people off of their land when they didn't want to leave.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And his dad was ruining the land because the projects that came upon those were a lot of the time very negative, fertilizer plants, like a lot of stuff. And so Cormac, from a young age, though, loved to explore the land, be a part of the land, and get to know all these people. So he lived in the rich boy house, but all around him were people in poverty. So he got to know these people. He got to know people who were in the Civil War who were born before the Civil War, who grew up during the Civil War, weren't in the Civil War. Maybe if they were really old, he did. So he got to hear these old stories, and he connected with that, and he started to see the evil that his father was doing. And his father and mother were very religious. They were Catholics, and they started pushing that upon him and make him go to church every Sunday. But I think he felt like his father was very controlling, and I think this is where the seeds of rebellion and kind of like a different interpretation of Christianity started to be sowed with him. And so he becomes just really fast. He becomes a big reader in high school, is a big rebel, eventually leaves Tennessee for a while, joins the Air Force, and comes back. And he comes back and he feels like he's the hottest man on the block, because if you read Cormac McCarthy's first novel, The Orchard Keeper, it's really good. It has problems, but he wrote it at 27 years old. And so if you are a 27-year-old in some random undergraduate writing workshop with a jerk-off professor who's not wrote shit, and you're sitting there and you're like, man, I'm fucking good. Like, I'm the man. And so he submits his novel to Random House, and they approve it immediately. And they're like, okay, we'll edit you, but we want to make some, or we'll publish you, but we want to make some changes. And this motherfucker's reply back is, no, you're not going to edit this. This is already perfect. So you could see he's got this ego, you know, he's got this ego, like, I'm good. And he obviously knew he was good. And so eventually he starts to make changes, but he eventually goes through a divorce. And the divorce happens because he met another writer at university. And she, and they have a kid. So they have a kid and she's working a job. So she's working a job and just had a kid. And they have no money. They're broke as hell. She's working minimum wage. And Cormac tells her, because, you know, this is Cormac's just trying to keep some hose around to clean the house. He tells her, you need to go get a second job and work 80 hours a week and take care of the baby.
Oh, my God.
And she's like, you know what? I'm not doing this. I'm getting out of here. And the same month that all this goes down and she leaves, he conceptualizes his second novel, Outer Dark, which is probably, I would say, the most Gnostic novel that he wrote. It's about father trauma. It's about a child, a brother and sister who have a baby, an incestuous baby, and the brother goes and leaves it out in the woods. And then they, anyway, it's a really dark novel, but there are a lot of themes of Gnosticism in them that eventually he plays with in Blood Meridian and other things. But this is when McCarthy starts to get into the darkness, because it's in Outer Dark was written and published in the 1960s. But as I'm sure you know, obviously know, Miguel, the Nag Hammadi Library was not translated in English until 1977. So he was using what's his name? Hans Jonas?
Yeah, Hans Jonas. Yeah.
Hans Jonas and others texts in the 60s and 50s that were popular to get the information he needed. So he was very into that. And also another big thing in the 1960s, if you were a young, intelligent man, was obviously existentialism, Camus, Sartre, all these other guys. And so he was in this darkness because he was being a sad boy. I've been to the archive and read his journals. After his wife leaves him, he's like, there's no one here for Thanksgiving. I'm so sad. Like we've all been there before. We get sad. You're low. Yeah. And he's like really sad though. And he's mentioning and quoting Camus and all these kind of darker figures. And he kind of goes through this dark period.
Hans Jonas was an existentialist. He was Heidegger's pupil. So
yeah, exactly. It's crazy, right? Wow. See, this is why I come on these shows, man. That's great. Like, damn, I didn't know that. Anyway, so at this, so he's in this dark phase, and eventually he meets his second wife, who's a rich girl from England, and she's like good looking and stuff, but she domesticates him. She makes Cormac the socialite. They go out, they wear suits, they live the life, and they're in poverty. And she's a rich girl. And eventually she's like, Cormac, you've been spending 6 years on a book about a necrophiliac. It's going to make us a couple thousand dollars in today's money, in like 2024 money. We have no food. We're begging. We have no heat. We have no running water. Can you maybe write a book that can make us some money? And you know what he said, Miguel?
What?
Hit the road, ho. I'm moving. He said, we're getting out of here.
Glad he didn't compromise.
And so in 1974, he leaves his second wife, gets divorced, and moves to the Southwest. He moves to Tucson, where I'm at right now. And he has a sexual and a mystical awakening. How do I know he has a sexual awakening? He said in his 1992 interview with, I forget who, that he had a young girlfriend. He's had young girlfriends and has mentioned this multiple times. So we're not talking about, he actually did approve money from Jeff Epstein at the Santa Fe Institute. We don't need to get into that right now, but oh, I mean, legally young girlfriends, 18 and up, but he's a 30-year-old who's a Mac. He publishes books. He's a brooding sad boy from Tennessee with an accent. Right. He's having a sexual awakening. He's sleeping around because this also is supported that when he was 55 in 1993, he married a 26-year-old for his third marriage. That means if you have a second wife who is a very principled lady after 10 years of marriage, the bed is probably not going to be exploding. And so he has a sexual awakening, but he also has a mystical awakening. We now see in the archive, in his readings, he's starting to read about Freemasonry, Carl Jung, all these different people. And then in 1977, the Nag Hammadi Library comes out as he's composing Blood Meridian, as he's composing No Country for Old Men, actually, which started as a screenplay. This all starts to explode for him, Gnosticism in general. Because before that, I've read the early drafts of Blood Meridian, and there is no Judge Holden. I mean, he's there because Judge Holden, he's a historical figure, but he's not mystical yet. There are no mystical elements. It's like a weird Western where they ride around and kill people. It feels like a John Wayne movie. That's how it read. Obviously, it's an early draft. And that's something McCarthy actually does. He starts things very bland and adds mystical elements later. That's kind of his writing process. He kind of gets the story down and then adds mysticism to it later. So he gets really deep into the cult, a bunch of stuff we're going to talk about in a second. But then to kind of multiply this, in 1981, he wins the MacArthur Fellowship, and this enables him to hang out with the greatest scientists in the world. Murray Gell-Mann, who was the Nobel Prize winning physicist a couple years before that, all these other guys, Cormac McCarthy gets to hang out with these guys. And most of the time, the MacArthur Fellowship is an award for people who of excellence of all different fields. But he tells the story of when he showed up there, there was all these other writers. They didn't know what to do because it was mostly scientists and the mathematicians and stuff. And these writers didn't know how to talk to these people. But he was already in love with science. So he became friends with all these guys and started to explore physics and all these things at a very deep level and interacting with the best scientists in the world on a one-on-one basis. And this is where he starts to understand the deeper layers of darkness in the universe, because when you start to understand quantum physics and reality, it's basically Gnosticism on steroids. Yes. We're like, oh my God, we're really out here. We're really far from the God above God. It's like, oh,
this is
shit.
A simulation. Nothing's real. Oh, yeah. Shit.
Yeah, exactly. So he starts to really discover that. That's really his biography about how he got into this, these deeper levels of darkness.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, that's an excellent summary of McCarthy. So it's fascinating how it all came together, how it was all destiny. So awesome. Where do we go next? Again, I have lots of questions, but I want you
to... questions? You have any questions, man? I'll answer them right now.
Well, let me ask Graham. Anything pop out to you, Graham, that you want to ask?
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
The only one that popped out to me is something that hasn't been mentioned, and he seems to be drawing from that long line of great Irish writers. They have so many Nobel Prize winners for literature. And I was curious if what signs of the Irish tradition showed in his writing?
Mostly Yeats, whatever we want. What is it, Yeats or Yeats?
Yeats.
Yeats. Yeah. Sorry, not Yeats. Sorry. Yeah. Yeats. Yeats' poem "Sailing to
Byzantium.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's the main complaint on my channel. I don't pronounce anything right. I just don't care usually. Same. I read it as is. Anyway,
it's all made up. Yeah, like you said, it's all made up.
That was the Yeats poem was actually the inspiration for No Country for Old Men, and so he was a big fan of Ireland, the Irish writers. James Joyce, big fan of James Joyce. Yep, just had to reconfirm. He's a fan of James Joyce, very inspired by Joyce. But he also, this is a crazy story, when he was in Ireland, that's where he worked on a lot of The Road. I think that's where he got the main inspirations for The Road. He was staying in a hotel in El Paso with his child. Then he saw like a forest fire on the hill, and that's what kind of inspired the idea. But then he let it sit for a couple of years, but then he worked it out in Ireland. So he actually spent a lot of time in Ireland, and it seemed to be kind of a place where he went to write in the later stages of his life, because there's multiple accounts of him going there. So yeah, there's a lot of Irish influence, and I think he is Irish, obviously. Yeah. Cormac. Anyway, for sure.
and also we should mention Yeats obviously leaned heavily on Gnostic. I mean, you can see it through his poems and his idea of the wild rose. Many people said that's just a cipher for Sophia's return. Scholars have written on this. So yeah, and of course Yeats was just big time magician occultist. Another person we should mention too, Ian, wasn't William James really an influence on him too?
Oh, of course. Obviously. Cause that, yeah.
So that's, yeah. So those are the awesome, the influences on McCarthy. Where do we go next?
You know, I think we should start with Blood Meridian, because it's the kind of,
that's what I wanted to go.
Yeah. Because I did listen to your interview with Petra Mundick that you did a long time ago. So I'm going to talk about stuff that she didn't get to. You guys should go check that out back on the OG channel of Miguel's. He has a great interview with kind of probably one of the best McCarthy scholars. I need to get her email from you. Honestly, I can't find, she vanished.
I can't find her on the internet after she published her book, you know, a Bloody and Barbarous God, which is an amazing book. I can't find her, and even her publisher doesn't know where she is. She's not teaching.
Did you
anywhere.
Try to reach out? Yeah, I heard.
Yeah,
that
I did reach out to her publisher. Yeah,
me too. Yeah, I heard that. I heard a whisper that she's a high school teacher in Australia, just living normie life. So that could be a rumor.
How does somebody not have any sort of online footprint?
I know. I mean, it's crazy. These geniuses. That's kind of the main call of my channel, and why I don't dislike, but it's of scholarship and academics and stuff. I'm like, guys, you are so smart. Like, she is so smart. I wish I could sit here and quote Chaucer and Dante off the top of my head like she was. I listened to the podcast last night. Like, I'm a fucking idiot compared to her. But she's not online. I win the game. I'm smarter than her because she's not here, you know? Sorry, but there's all these geniuses in my comment section. These guys leave, I'm sure that happens to you all the time, they leave like 18 paragraphs. You're like, dude, who are you?
Brilliant people. Brilliant. Yeah. But they're brilliant. It's like, well, then, yeah, create some content. The more light we spread, the better things will get very fast. And thanks, Petra, for writing that book and doing your research. I mean, it made a difference in our lives. So that's good.
Yeah. Shout out to her. So there's been a lot of great scholars on Gnosticism and stuff. But we're going to talk about some new stuff today. Let me think. Okay, so in Blood Meridian, McCarthy evokes the four Western arts of divination: the Kabbalah, Freemasonry, Tarot. What? Hold on. Oh, not Freemasonry. Sorry, that's not in there. Sorry, astrology, Tarot, numerology, and the Kabbalah, the four Western arts of divination, because they all connect to each other. As I'm sure you've heard about many times before, they all help you access and understand the different archetypes.
Let's stop. We should give, for those that don't know, a quick plot to Blood Meridian. There is no plot, really. It's about these vicious scalping gang going in the Southwest, killing Indian and Mexicans, and then they get their comeuppance many times. And I guess the two figures are the judge, the demiurge figure, and the kid, who's sort of the Christ figure. And that's it, right? I mean, but it's so visceral and vivid and beautiful and mystic. It just washes over you and just like Flannery O'Connor. She's so vicious, but you feel your soul rise. Again, awe and terror at the same time. And it just... it splits your psyche, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's a great description. Just a quick plot. That's one of the funny things about McCarthy. Also, some of his novels, there's no plot. Like a lot of the time, you're like, he just doesn't do it. He just throws it out. Like you think, yeah. Like you always hear, like you got to study the, you have to focus on characters or plots, and like he does, none of his characters talk. And then Sometimes there's no point in any of his novels. Like they just walk around. Like,
yeah, yeah, they're almost like walking ideals. I mean, Stanley Kubrick and David Lynch do that. They're not fleshed out characters. They're just symbols of something to bring the ideas forward. And he does it just excellently. So.
And that's a good, I mean, we'll get to back to this in a second, but one of the main themes of Blood Meridian and a lot of The Row, No Country for Old Men, all of his novels really, is the idea of the pilgrim, of the migrant, of the spiritual wanderer, the spiritual interloper. Same with David Lynch, especially like in Twin Peaks. Right. That's what, what's her name? Laura Palmer. She's the spiritual interloper and they go into Black Lodge, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. Don't get me going on that. But yeah, so... Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I know. So whenever do you want me to hop in? Do you want to start talking about Blood Meridian?
No. Go for it.
All right.
We were at the four divinations. So now, yeah, because this is a Western. It's a visceral, realistic Western, and it's historically accurate. The way they talk, everything is amazing. But again, there's all this mysticism, right? It's just there.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, honestly, there was a massive explosion, obviously, of mysticism in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so all these ideas and things, especially with someone like Judge Holden, who is this kind of penultimate thinker and knows everything, like he obviously is going to be versed in that stuff. And, you know, what's crazy about McCarthy is that to know all this and write about it at this level and stick all this stuff in there, he had to be very versed too. Like people think like, you know, let me just say it right now. There is an overblownness of people thinking that Cormac McCarthy is a Christian. He talks about Christianity in his novels. There are Christian symbols. There is a ton of that in there. But what we were all, I know, Miguel, you were a Roman Catholic at one point in your life. I'm sure almost everyone out there was raised with some form of Christianity. And that was the main framing of our, that was like one of the first programs installed into our brain as children, you know, the way to frame reality. Even if we didn't believe it, we're like, man, there's this God and he might have retribution. So a lot of us have that within us. And there are a lot of people who go throughout life and they've never really read, they've never pursued the intellectual arts. And so when they confront a book confront Cormac McCarthy and they see these symbols in there, the only framing of reality they have that's somewhat literary, because the Bible is obviously literature, is the Bible. And 62% of Americans identify as Christian. So there's this kind of big overblownness of Christianity. It's not really in scholarship. There's almost no scholarship on that because they're smart enough to realize, but like on Reddit and in the comment sections. So I just kind of want to bring that up really fast, that he's not a Christian, that he moved away from that. And a lot of this is very not just Gnostic, but just kind of a pantheon of Eastern thought and other Western thoughts. Like he's kind of putting it all in there. The four Western arts of divination are tools for revelation and gnosis. They aren't, you maybe if you believe in it, can use them for divination, telling the future, all this other stuff. But they were ways, because we were being oppressed by Christianity, to carry knowledge, to talk about the different archetypes of the soul and psychology and all these different things. That's what they're meant for. And they all connect to each other, all four: numerology, Kabbalah, astrology, and tarot. If once you understand them fluently, they actually all have a correspondence with each other. And so all four are present in Blood Meridian. And we're first going to talk about astrology and somewhat of numerology, because in Blood Meridian, this is a question for Miguel, McCarthy references the number 8 dozens of times and makes it a big symbol. What is the number 8 represent? What's the number 8 have to do with Gnosticism? What's the big kahuna of 8?
Well, that would be the Ogdoad, yep. Which in Hermeticism, Gnosticism is sort of a very, not the demiurge heaven, but the good heaven. I think in his first novel, Stasi, he also talks about the Ogda. So he knows what he's doing, and 8 is eternity. I think 888 is a number for Jesus. So yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so the Ogdoad, we're going to be talking about that a lot. And he actually references that in Blood Meridian. There's so many symbols. I mean, just so many overt, just in Outer Dark. He actually mentions the word Gnostic in Outer Dark. And so the number eight is mentioned dozens of times, and it embodies what Miguel just said, obviously the Ogdoad, which we'll get into a second, and many other things. And so the first Gnostic symbol that he connects it to, and actually I will present my screen right now to get a quote going. Here we go.
All right, everybody, while he does that, we've got Ian discussing the Gnostic Cormac McCarthy, and let me get it over here. Here we go. You are...
Okay, so
let me get rid of that cross, that ankh, real quick.
It just says that right there. It's all good. The survivors lay quietly in that cratered void and watched the white hot stars go rifling down the dark, or slept with their alien hearts beating in the sand like pilgrims exhausted upon the face of the planet Anoreta, clutched to a namelessness, wheeling in the night. And so when we're looking at this quote, first and foremost, everybody, there are different... Before we even get to the Anoreta, which we're going to talk about, there are different Gnostic symbols here. First of all, they're laying in this cratered void. And what? So they're, first of all, they're sleeping with their alien hearts. What are they alien to? They're here on this cratered void. They're like pilgrims. What are, you know, upon this planet of Anoreta, which is actually, so the planet Anoreta is an old astrological term that signifies the planet of death. In Western tropical astrology, that's the eighth house, which symbolizes death. So they are exhausted upon the face of the planet Anoreta, which is symbolized, which is the eighth house of astrology, once again, this eight coming out, and which is the prison planet, the demiurge's creation that we're living on now. McCarthy gives it away all right here. They're the pilgrims, yeah. They're aliens. It's all right here. But no one knows what this word Anoreta is. If you guys have never read Cormac, he literally has the entire Oxford American Dictionary memorized. He says the most esoteric, sometimes he says words that I look up on Google. They're not, you can't find it. You have to research, and there's forum posts where people discuss it and figure out what it means. Like, and because if you guys don't know, the Oxford English Dictionary, which is out of print now, was 20 volumes long, like 20 big volumes long. To get a set online, it costs like $2,000 now. And so there's all these esoteric words in there. And so I guess like Anoreta, that was probably at the start, you know, he probably got to that one in book one. There is no, you know, you would have to be pretty deep into studying the occult and astrology to hear Anoreta. And so he covers the number eight to the Anoreta. And hold on, let's see what I was going to talk about. You know, and something also interesting to note, which, you know, I know a lot of you guys don't believe in astrology out there, and that's fine. But if McCarthy was this deep into astrology, and there's a ton of other astrological terms in Blood Meridian, we're not going to get into those today. You know, the blood red sun, there's a ton of meteor showers, the Big Dipper, different constellations, references to a false moon. He's really into it. So I would assume that he could have calculated his birth chart in, you know, the 1970s when he was doing this. And so in McCarthy's eighth house are his Mercury and his Mars. In Leo, and Mercury is obviously dealing with knowledge, and Mars is dealing with action. So what is Cormac McCarthy's life? It is one of dealing with death through knowledge and action. His whole life is talking about death in his novels, and then his action is writing those novels. And it's in Leo, which is the most steroid ambitious sign there is. And that's why we see, you know, him pushing through even when it's hard. He doesn't care about the pain. I'm the best. That's the most Leo. What are you, Miguel? What's your
Taurus?
Taurus. There he is. Yeah. Look at you, man. You've been holding down the fort for 10 years.
Oh yeah. Can't stop.
So that's the astrology of the number eight in Blood Meridian, that it connects to Anoreta, which is the eighth house. Moving forward to numerology. So in chapter 15 of Blood Meridian, there's something. So at the start of every chapter in Blood Meridian, I wish I could, I don't need it. We can stop screen sharing. Grab it really fast. I see it right here.
All right. Cool. Yeah. We got Ian Katanak. He is discussing Cormac McCarthy, and he went to grab something. Yeah, again, if you have any questions, please super chat them. This is AM by Gnostic Radio. And
so if we see at the start of every single chapter, he gives a preview of what's going to happen in that chapter, right? And this is called synoptic chapter headings. This is old Westerns used to do this. This is a very classic thing because it's kind of weird. Like, why tell everyone what's about to happen? But it's kind of cool. It's just kind of this like throwback, you know, because he gives respect. Cormac McCarthy, everyone, if you want, on my channel, I talk about this all the time. he steals hard. Like any great writer, people think that you just write and you just do it. But every great writer is a great reader and even a better stealer of information. He steals direct lines, direct ideas, direct things all the time from people. And just, you know, who's going to check you in 1963? And it obviously doesn't. No,
That's normal. I mean, I'm doing this research on Elvis Presley and David Bowie are the two biggest thieves in the history of the music business. And this is their answer when you call them on them. F you, I stole it. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's kind of seen as something weird, like it's plagiarism or something. It's kind of this weird. I think that's embedded in our mind because of copyright and intellectual property, which I don't really believe in, you know, because we think we own this thing. But who cares if someone steals your jokes and makes people laugh? Like, fuck it. Like, that's great. Like, we're telling stories. You should tell people and obviously give credit. But you're standing, when you steal from someone, you're standing upon someone's shoulders because you're stealing a line, an idea. But in a 130,000 word novel, that means nothing. Like, that doesn't make the good book, you know, him stealing doesn't make, like, he's not doing that because he's a bad writer. He's doing that because he's a good writer and he reads. So he does these synoptic chapter headings. And in chapter 15, he mentions the Ogawad. Sorry.
Ogawad.
Ogawad.
We don't know. We weren't there. So whether it's saying Sophia or Demiurge or Ogawad,
yeah,
who knows? But
So the Ogawad is in the Gnostic cosmology, like the highest level, right? Like there's the seven layers and that's the highest level. And he, in the chapter, this is a reference to a circle of eight men who are talking. But all throughout the novel, and we can actually connect to some of this right now, I'll show you guys how he uses number eight, because he uses it as a way to, as a premonition of death, because as you just heard, so if you look at your astrology chart right now, it's believed by some schools of thought that placements in your eighth house are negative, that are going to, it's a negative premonition that you need to watch out in that area of life because something bad may happen. And McCarthy mirrors that same concept in his fiction. And I will present again, actually.
There you go. Let's get you back on. Where are you? Add you to the stage. Now we're there. We are back.
We're going to kind of do, I'm going to walk you through this. Hopefully it doesn't, you know, it's an exercise to really show you guys how he does this. So on the left side, it's a left to right column. We're going to see something at the start of the novel. And this is taken, I got this chart from a guy named, I think, William Wickley. He put this chart together. Yeah. William Wickley. Yeah. He put this chart together. So thank you to him. At the start of the novel, the kid tells a story of eight fictitious bandits to Captain White. Later in the story, eight real bandits appear in possession of the slain Captain White's horse. So in the story, we see this transition after Captain White dies from the Comanche attack. One of the most iconic scenes of the novel is when they find eight dead babies are hung in a tree. Later on, one of the callers tells of eight whores sitting in a tree. Why the number eight? Why is it? It's not a synchronicity. It's not like he just randomly picked that number. There's obviously synchronicities here. Glanton turns in eight heads for a bounty. Later on, a bounty of 8,000 pesos is later put on Glanton's head. Next, 128 native scalps redeemed are for a bounty plus eight heads. Later on, 28 Mexicans are shot dead in the tavern plus eight in the street. So you guys get the point. We don't need to go through the other two, but eventually these are used as a premonition, and this is great. So to all you writers out there, to all you fiction authors, I want to give you guys some advice. This actually happens a lot in the kind of the Gnostic spiritual conspiracy kind of, you know, weird community that I've been a part of for a long time. You get someone who, has been doing presentations. They've been on the circuit. They have a channel, right? And they're like, I want to write fiction. I'm going to write fiction. So they write a novel and, you know, and it's released and it's a nice plot, but then it feels like they're preaching to you throughout the novel. You're like, they're trying to tell you it's all about Gnosticism. It's all about this. It's all about, you know, and you're like, dude, you have to hide it. You have to let me find it. You don't want it to be so overt. I don't want to get preached to, even if it's what I believe in. Like, that's for dumb people. Like, you know, it's an art form. You know what I mean? Cause things aren't that direct in people's minds and like reality. Like, it's not like, hey, look, it's like, it's not like the Truman Show where like they do an ad placement. Like, no.
No, indeed. And you got to respect the symbols.
I can't remember what I was talking about. I'm sorry.
You were talking about numerology. Oh, want to talk about the? Oh, no, go ahead.
So McCarthy, so for all my writers out there, you have to hide these things because, and it's not just stealing ideas. So McCarthy found this idea of the eighth house, but he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to mention, Judge Holden wasn't like, I got an eighth house in Mercury. Like that's kind of sounds dumb, right? That sounds out of place. That doesn't fit well, but that is something a beginner writer or intermediate writer would do. So instead, he hides it behind this weird singular reference to Anaretta. And then for those who can find it, the number eight and the transition of death and, you know, the placement. And so like that, it's pretty cool to see this kind of in action, but this is something you should be thinking about. You should be, this is the key of the Hermetic arts. You have to hide it from people. And see if they can find it, because your unconscious knows. When I was 15 years old and I read Blood Meridian, I didn't see any of the shit. When I was 19, 20, I didn't know this. You didn't know this, Miguel. But eventually it's revealed to us when we take the right path, when we walk the walk, when we do these things, when we study deeper, we find these things. When you follow Miguel and now are hearing me speak, you have been taken here by fate. And so, yeah. It's a big deal, you guys. And that's what we're doing as fiction authors. We have to transform people's lives. What are you doing? Why are you writing? You want to be the cool guy? Oh yeah, I wrote a book. No, you're trying to make an impact in people's minds. That's what we love. All the books that Miguel just mentioned, he loves. I love them too, because when I finished, I was different after it.
Yeah. You experience them. They change your consciousness. You're initiated into the mysteries.
Yeah. Okay. So the next... So far we've covered astrology and numerology. Next, we're going to look at the number eight in the tarot and see how that functions for us. So in Blood Meridian, the kid is given the Four of Cups, which is interesting because it's a minor arcana card. You know, a lot of the other characters got major arcana cards, and most people only know the major arcana. When you talk to people about the tarot, they get lost when they start seeing, you know, a dude with four cups. What does this mean? And the definition of this card, which the kid gets at near the start of the novel before anything too crazy happens, is a young man is seated under a tree and contemplates three cups set on the grass before him. An arm issuing from a cloud offers him another cup. His expression, notwithstanding, is one of discontent with his environment. Weariness, disgust, aversion, imaginary vexations, as if the wine of this world had caused satiety only. Another wine, as if a fairy gift is now offered the water stool, but he sees no consolation therein. This is also a card of blended pleasure. And so that's what this is talking about. When we see the kid, he is not wholly evil yet. He's not Judge Holden. He's in this novel and he's been roped into this group. So at the start of the novel, he is just wandering. He gets roped into this group of filibusters. And if you guys don't know the history of this, this is wild. Where do you live, Miguel, if you don't mind me asking?
Northern Illinois. I did live in Texas for 14 years.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to don't mess with fucking Texas, anybody. No. The last real state. I know one of my buddies from Texas is in the chat right now. But the history of Texas is wild because the precursor to Blood Meridian is the best part of the story. And so the Comanche were given horses by... I think French traders or someone, and they go crazy with it. The Comanches dominate the landscape. They're fucking everyone up. They're like the Mongols, like reincarnated.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're crazy. So they would ride, they could ride 400 or 500 miles at minimum down into Mexico and just raid and fuck everybody up and ride back. And so Mexico was like, dude, this sucks. Because at the time, this was the Spanish. The Spanish were in control and they were losing all this money. They're like, dude, we don't want to deal with this anymore. And I think actually in 1832, after the Mexican Revolution, anyway, the Mexicans couldn't really allocate enough resources to keep back the Comanches. So they paid a bunch of people from Virginia, white people, to move into northern Texas, to move into kind of the Dallas area and across that kind of meridian right there. And they were using it as a guard to shield themselves because they're like, the Comanche will come through and fuck them up. And they'll fight back and we'll have this kind of barrier of white people. And so that's how they got brought to Texas. And eventually all those guys like Sam Houston and all those families, they made Texas. This is our land now. This ain't no Mexican land. This is our land. So the Texas Revolution happened. But in 18, like 30 something, so Texas was its own country for like a year, but eventually they called upon the United States for help because of obviously Mexico was starting to fuck with them, but also the Comanche still. They wanted more protection and the U.S. government. And so that kind of is, and so eventually America, the Mexican-American War happens in like what, the 1940s, 50s. I don't know when that happens, but eventually Mexico, we eventually go to war with Mexico and take Texas and California, Arizona and stuff. And we take the land back, and that's where this novel starts. And so after the Mexican-American War, the kid goes and gets in with this group of scalp hunters, because the Mexican government at the time, making the same mistake they did the first time. The reason I mentioned that is the first time they gave some white people money to keep the Comanches out. And so they give the Glanton gang eventually money to keep them. That's not who you want to hire. So a bunch of white men go down into Mexico, and the kid is one of them, to get scalps for money. And eventually they all get killed in the famous Comanche attack scene, which is one of the greatest and most violent scenes in literature, as Miguel talks about.
Detail of what the Comanches would do to you. I'd rather face the Mongols because it's so visceral and
yeah, they were mean. I mean, and I love Blood Meridian for that reason. Like, we have this romanticized Indian now that like they're peaceful and they were just pagans. They were so violent to each other. And the Comanches were the ones that got kicked out of Wyoming. The Crows and all them kicked them out. They were the weak. They were like the weaklings. And so like after battles, the women would come out and chop all the enemy's genitals off. And this was common. Like, you know, so all groups of people all across the world are bad. Like, it's not you're just because you're white or the Mexicans suck in this novel. The Indians suck and the white people suck. They're all violent and you know, are terrible people. And
Terra Damnata, it really is a damned place.
Yeah, exactly. And so so the kid after the attack meets up with his the Glanton gang, which is actually a historical group of individuals, and McCarthy steals from the story. So a lot of the events in Blood Meridian are mirrored from Samuel Chamberlain's book My Confession, and the kid is actually somewhat of a representation of Samuel Chamberlain himself. And so imagine you kind of are with this group of scalp hunters. And so it's fun. Like, holy shit, we all romanticize this. This is why Blood Meridian is popular, because in our head at night, we really sometimes it's fun to imagine riding around, pillaging, killing people. Like, that's why we love Westerns. That's why we don't romanticize, any period more than that. You could go to Mongolia right now and talk about cowboys and Indians, and they would know that. They would, anyone in the world knows that mythos of America, cowboys and Indians. It's really important for us. And so it's hard though, because if you are a somewhat moral person, even the worst of us are, and you're doing that, you're going to have these blended pleasures. You're going to be indifferent. And that's why McCarthy, I think, gives the kid the Four of Cups. I know that was kind of a very long-winded analysis of that. So throughout the novel, as you see, he also mirrors the same thing. He tells the story of the number 8 in the minor arcana through the story. So if we look at this photo here on the right, this is representing the section at the start of the novel. With darkness, one soul rose wondrously from among the new slain dead and stole away in the moonlight. And this is the kid when he was alone after the Comanche attack. He's on foot. A couple survivors leave him, and he has to walk on foot at night because the desert's so hot to try and find safety. And this is the 8 of Cups. Next, we have the 8 of Swords, the woman, and this is McCarthy. These are quotes by McCarthy on page 99. The woman sat like the blind
Don't ask me.
Lotrix between Boaz and Jachin, inscribed upon that one card in the juggler's deck that they would not see come to light. True pillars and true card, false prophetess for all. He literally says true card, false. And she's bound. She's blind and bound. And this is actually in the scene with the tarot cards, because they're giving out tarot cards. So I'm just showing you guys example how he's using the tarot, like hidden in Blood Meridian. Next, we have page 285. A second arrow passed him on the left, and two more struck the lodge fast in his chest and groin. They were full 4 feet in length, and they lofted slightly with movements like ceremonial wands. There we go, the 8 of wands, like all the number 8. Like, he's drawing from anything he can find with 8. And then last but not least, and this is the most apparent, like, this seals the deal in my book. The fool was no longer there, but another man, and this other man he could never see in his entirety, but he seemed an artisan and worker in metal. He was a cold forger who worked with hammer and die. A cold forger is a coin maker, and this is one of the main symbols of Judge Holden, who is, so Judge Holden, everybody, is either the Demiurge or a lower or a higher Archon, like a pretty close Archon to the Demiurge, you know, either one. And one of the symbols of the Demiurge is, what the Demiurge did was create an illusionary world of symbol, which, you know, a simulacra. And so there's a dream that involves Judge Holden, and there's this cold forger, as we see here, who are creating these coins, and they're actually false coins. And McCarthy kind of makes a commentary here about Judge Holden, and Holden gets things. Anytime Holden gets insects, rocks, and birds and draws them in his notebook to contain and own the world, because without what exists without my knowledge also what also exists without my consent. A whatever consent. That famous
oh, I love that quote. God, I love that quote. Yeah,
whatever that one is. But that's what he's saying. He's trying to map out and symbolize the world, which is what the Demiurge would do. Because in two different interpretations of Gnosticism, in one could be the Demiurge is just totally ignorant of all this, but in the other interpretation, the Demiurge is knowledgeable of but he's trying to shield everybody else. He's trying to shield that they're living in this illusionary world. And that's what the latter interpretation is, what McCarthy embodies, because when we see Judge Holden all throughout the novel, he's trying to keep people down. He's trying to hold people down, honestly. He's trying to do misrepresentation with them, because a lot of people, I think, ignorantly read Judge Holden as an objective figure, one could say, a speaking truth, because we like his words. We see that that's how the West was, that there was this will to power, this Nietzschean thing.
Right.
But I have a post out there, and it talks about, is Judge Holden a prophet or just like a blind seducer or like a seducer? And I think that he's actually seducing them, that he's pushing a lot of his knowledge is actually creating simulacra to confuse them. And this is very apparent with the kid at the end of the novel, when the judge is hunting the kid and Tobin, the ex-priest, he's mad at him. He's like, this is your fault. This is your fault. I'm trying to kill you because you didn't take a side. You didn't fully become moral and not engage with any of this, but you didn't fully become evil. And this is what the Demiurge wants us to do, because when we are in polarity, when we are engaging and not at one with ourselves and going up the middle path to Gnosis, we are engaged in life. Vote Daddy Trump or Mommy Biden, polarity day and night. That's what we're that's the antithetical.
Right.
You know, that's what it's trying to make us do. That's what all this dream world is about. It's not trying to help us, you know, that it's always in polarity.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten. And the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.